there's a lot of focus then around, well, how does AI then fill that gap? And therefore we're at this cusp of, you know, with where we've, you know, compute and quantum compute and the storage costs going down, that, you know, AI is now at that, as everyone knows, kind of inflection point. And, you know, it's really around how do we use AI to drive more efficiency in what we do and be way more effective in what we do, as opposed to necessarily replacing jobs or replacing roles, but giving you back that time.
Data Futurology has three exciting conferences coming up in the second half of the year. We have Data Engineering on the 5th of September in Sydney, followed by Advancing AI on the 6th and 7th of September in Sydney. And then October 24th and 25th, we're going to have our Ops World event in Melbourne. Our conferences cover three main pillars: executive perspectives on leadership and strategy in the space, industry use cases and case studies, and then the third one is advancements in the technologies. Come and find out what's happening in the community. Bring your teams along. Get everyone together. It's going to be three great events. Hope to see you there.
I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors, Talent Insights. Talent Insights are Australia's leading specialist data recruitment business. With offices in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane, they're experts at providing recruitment strategy and building data teams for clients across industries Australia-wide. They provide recruitment solutions for all roles across the data lifecycle, including data engineering, data science, advanced analytics, customer and marketing insights, business intelligence, data product managers, and data governance. They're skilled at finding the best permanent and contract hires for your business needs, as well as statement of work, project focus, data resources. At Talent Insights, relationships matter most. I can say from first-hand experience, Talent Insights are fantastic to work with. Whether you're a business leader within an HR network or a specialist data candidate, Talent Insights should be the first company you turn to for all your data recruitment needs. Find them at talentinsights.com.au.
So now we're going to jump into the live podcast recording. We're going to be talking about the future of AI, applications of AI, and what is going to be coming down the pipe. And for that, we're joined by Orla Glynn. She's the executive for AI reporting, insights, and automation configuration at Telstra. Please welcome Orla. Orla, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for joining. I'm so keen to pick your brain. I know that you have a very unique, I think you describe it as non-linear path to AI. Could you give us a bit of your background and then we'll jump into your role and your remit at the moment. But tell us about how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, so it's probably a long and winding story around how I've ended up here. But you know, I've had a very varied career and a very, as I said, non-linear and non-traditional. The common kind of thread throughout my career has very much been my drive to constantly be learning, and as well as that, you know, the sense of curiosity and problem solving. So I grew up in a family where my dad is a mathematician and studied physics and chemistry, or taught physics and chemistry. My mom is a geography, Irish, and history teacher, amongst other subjects. So I had this real love for the humanities subjects as well as the science subjects, and could never decide which side I wanted to go down. So I actually started in university, and I'm not going to go through my whole career, but I think it's good context. I actually started off studying archaeology, art Amazing. History, and sociology. I dropped out after a little bit and went back and studied business and law, and I majored in law and corporate finance. And at the same time I was at university, I also had a summer job in Boston at MIT Media Lab, where I was working directly for Dr. John Maida, who was the director of the Media Lab, and was just fascinated by what they were doing. And it was like quite early, so it was 2000 and 2001 when I was working there. And you know, when I came back from those two summers, I was like, oh, this technology space is super cool. But yeah, Pivoting from law to tech didn't seem like the right choice. And worked in everything from M&A to corporate recovery, forensic accounting. So very much data focused. And then after 9 years of studying and working, I moved to Australia just for a working holiday for 6 months. And 16 years later, here I am. I have worked across you know, finance roles as an accountant, and then moved into, led into kind of leading data teams and then data transformation and then digital and then innovation and then back to data now again. So yeah, lots of different roles.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And how did you start the foray into data throughout that career? Because I really like how you've kind of weaved in and out of the space, but carrying so many other skills that you developed throughout that are so relevant in the data analytics space, and then blending that with transformation and going kind of like much, much broader, in which data analytics is a component of. So I really like that journey. How did you start getting into data, and how do you see that supporting the transformation and innovation work that you're doing now?
Yeah, so I guess in finance roles, you know, I was looking at the investment banking platforms, or I was looking at the next, you know, migration that was happening, and I sort of sat as the translator between the tech and the business and finance.
Yeah.
And then through many different restructures, I ended up in an operations division, which then decided it got the role of the chief data officer. And because I had the strategy background, I ended up helping around, you know, what that function would look like. And then from there, it was really, you know, taking a bit of a leap and really focusing on what I want. I really wanted to focus on data, digital, and innovation as my three kind of growth areas. And I really doubled down into those and made very conscious decisions to move laterally in my career for about 6 years to do that. And I chose roles where I was going to be exposed to those learning opportunities as opposed to necessarily being promoted up because I wanted to have a title, even though it was nice to get a title. But you know, that was a kind of shift in mindset for me around following a, you know, kind of accounting-y, finance-y career trajectory versus actually really thinking about from a growth mindset, like what I really like doing. And yeah, I spent the last 12 years in that data and AI space, and it's just fun. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. No, I really like how you were, got the strategy background, the finance side, the transformation. No, it all plays in so nicely together. And tell us about your remit at the moment. What are you working on now?
Yeah, so I've got one of the longest titles, which we've summarized into ARIA. So AI reporting, insights, and automation configuration. Mm-hmm. So I lead about 600 people, maybe just a little under 600. And at Telstra, we've got a chapter group model. So effectively, the chapter is where the people reside, and then they flow to work out in the groups. So I've got a cross-company chapter, and they flow out to all across Telstra. So be it into the customer side of things or the Telstra enterprise, GBS or shared services center or products or networks. So the people that sit in my team, you know, have a breadth across the whole organization. And then my role, I've got kind of two hats. The chapter hat is very much around the leadership component of the people and focusing on the people capability. There's a T25 scorecard around uplifting our data and AI capability by 25%. So there's a real focus on like, what are the skills, what are the learning paths, what's the career progression of those roles, and then more broadly then from a workforce transformation perspective, what's the uplift of our non-data roles to be more data and AI literate as well. And then my other side of the role is working with my peers, Dale Stevens and Sandy Cameron, who I'm sure many people know. So really looking at like, what's the broader data and AI transformation for Telstra. Look, we measure that at the moment based on our, like what we call our core data roles. So, you know, any of the roles that sit within my chapter or the engineering chapter. And then what we're looking at is then what's the secondary data skills in the organization. And then more broadly, then what might be the, as a workforce, what's the maturity uplift that we need to do around your data and AI quotient, so your technology quotient, and what would that look like? So we're in the process of sort of developing that roadmap around how we uplift more broadly the whole workforce what that looks like, especially now with, obviously, everyone's been talking about generative AI, but even more so, it's becoming more incredibly important for us to focus on that.
Yeah, definitely. So then do you see that that's going to focus on kind of technical training throughout the organization, that people will be completing technical courses kind of regardless of their work at the moment, or something different? How do you see that taking shape?
Yeah, it's so I guess in the chapter we offer, we're building out both the technical and then the non-technical learning. So technical, I mean, the team themselves have, you know, lots of PhDs and masters and are and love doing certifications, and we offer them and we're building content with them that's the right content for them. But then more broadly across the organization, we're looking at, well, we're at very early stages of this, but we're trying to figure out how to make it in a way that's sort of more gamified and more connecting into their day-to-day jobs as well. So we're working through different scenarios around how that would play out. So, you know, it's a combination of the technical, but then also like what's the fundamentals, simplifying it down versus then depending on your persona, what level we want to go into. So it's very much tailored for the audience.
That's phenomenal. And you've got such a unique role, remit and perspective that you're thinking about creating an organization of the future, how to transform the organization and the workforce at a massive, massive scale. How do you start to plan that to like bring together what needs to change in order to uplift the capability in the organization and create this future for the company?
Yeah, so I guess specifically in Telstra, I mean, they went out in their T25 strategy and set a pretty bold ambition around AI and the role it'll play both in the next few years, but then more broadly. And we've made commitments with that, with the investment in Quantium and Telstra as well. So, you know, there's good, you know, it's a very clear strategic vision and appetite for this. The big part that we're focusing on the moment is making certain the board and C-suite are very much engaged in this, and that they're aware and educated around both the value opportunities that we have, but then also the risks that we need to trade off and how we would look to that. So we're, you know, it's a, I don't want to use the word, it's a journey, but there's an awful lot of engagement and, you know, strategic influencing happening at the very top to kind of say, this is how we want to build this out. Mm. And we've taken different ways around how we're approaching that. So it's a very hot topic at the moment, but, you know, in general, how do I go about it? It's multi-pronged around, vision, influencing, relationships, getting at my index of all the people I know and getting them to engage with different stakeholders at a very senior level to constantly reinforce the message around what we want to be doing. So, yeah.
That's really good. So, yeah, so you get obviously the team in there and getting them to be also moving in the same direction, having the same type of conversations and doing kind of like as a team effort, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, like I guess we're really, it's about where we're at the moment is very much trying to land on the story and the narrative so that we're sharp on what we want to do and very clear blueprint around the way forward, and in particular like what the milestones and roadmaps look like for that. You've got to be pretty clear around, you know, what you're going after and why you're going after it, and, you know, what's future-proofing versus what's actually securing your data.
Yes, exactly. And how much, how does your teams demonstrate or measure the value of their work at the moment? And how, and do you use that as a basis to extrapolate what could be done in the future as you uplift the capability throughout the organization?
Yeah, so we've in the last 6 months we've got sort of three key pillars that we've anchored behind. The first is deliver exceptional impact. For every single initiative that we're working on with the team flow to work, we're very clear on like what's the impact that they're having on our overall T25 strategy. So if it's flowing to customer areas, like what's the impact on customer experience? If it's looking at growth or productivity, we're clear on that. If it's impacting on reputation and improving reputation, how do we manage that? So, and then we also have a dollar component as well that we measure. Mm. So we look at what are our high value missions that we've kind of categorized all of our work into three layers. And of the high value missions, we've gone and actually fully quantified that. So we have quite a sizable value pool that we know that is fine. I'm still debating the economics of it, but we have a sizable value pool that we want to go after. Yeah,
that's phenomenal.
So we're very clear on the value pools. Like, we know what we want to look go after.
Amazing. That's great. And I'll hit you up with one more question, and then I'll start pulling in some from Slido. But if taking maybe a broader cross industry view, what are some of the areas that you see that need to change the most now with things like generative AI, with the advancements that have been coming up now, and thinking about the workforce of the future? What do you see as some of the changes that or the areas that will be most impacted by the progress of the technology?
Well, there's a few different ways of looking at that, I guess. We obviously, there's the value and the opportunity side of things, and then there's also managing the risk and then being very clear on the capabilities. So we did this really cool piece of work last year, which was perfect timing because it was just before the big GPT announcement, ChatGPT, where we really looked at, like, what's our future state risks. And it was a colleague of mine kind of was the brains behind doing this piece of work, so Ben Burge. Looked at, like, imagine it's 2028 or 2030, and we had scaled AI to the ambition of our strategy, then what would be the risks that we would have to think about? And in particular, you know, from our executive C-suite being, you know, this is the gift that you will inherit, or the next C-suite will inherit, if we don't do this properly now. And we really, you know, we took quite a, we brought in a consortium of people to work with us on it, but we really challenged these different hypotheses around what we were seeing, and actually started to look at, like, what's the risk ontology that we would need to think about within the organization, and then in particular how human and machine will need to coexist, and that divergent workforce will need to be in place. So when you start to think about the divergent workforce, and if you think about what we have today, where we've got policies and procedures and codes of conduct around our human workforce, well, what does that look like when you've got an AI-driven workforce that's making decisions? And therefore, how might we monitor that differently? And then if we were to monitor that with AI, how do we build that ecosystem today?
I really like that approach, because it's such a great analogy that with your people, you wouldn't want people to go, say, without training on the policies or on how to perform their job in a way that's aligned to the organization. And you want to have kind of the same types of processes for your AI. Like, you want your AI to be aligned.
Yeah, and I think the thing in telco in particular, like, it's such a complex industry. But, you know, when we actually started to map out the models that we had, you know, you can see, say, where a model sitting in the customer side of the business is actually dependent on, you know, the received experience in the network. So how the network is operating, and then the decisioning that's coming out of that network model, how does it feed into the customer model? And therefore, where's your stack decisioning happening, and what's the implications of that? And then, you know, trying to understand that ontology and how we're going to manage it becomes really, really interesting. And, you know, we played out different scenarios around, you know, what would happen to vulnerable customers, by way of example, if we had a decisioning engine here that was driving a decision that didn't take into account this. So it wasn't like just looking at ethical risk. It was, you know, it was looking at fundamentally what could happen if this all started to get out of control.
And how is the journey in terms of doing the investments for the future versus building what is sometimes required in the short term to either put out a fire or some short term priorities? How are you and the teams balancing the two sides?
The reality is we have to secure our data. You know, we have increased cyber threats. We have, you know, this year has been, you know, what happened to Optus was, you know, significant, and in Telstra we've really you know, keeping our customer data secure is critical, and all data secure. So there's a big program of work around that. And then you're trying to balance that investment with then actually we want to do generative AI and AI at scale. And how do you balance that? So it's an interesting tension to hold in the organization. And then, really engaging with the CEO and the board, on holding that tension and the productive discomfort that you've got to sit in. A lot of it is kind of education and, really getting them to understand the risks, but also balancing it with the opportunities, because we can tend to go too far risk. And then, at the end of the day, we're here to, improve the customer experience and, grow our business. So there's a balance.
I really like that term of productive discomfort. Can you talk a little bit more to that or about that?
Yeah, from an adaptive leadership perspective, one of the key concepts within it. And it's something that I actually spend a lot of time I've got 52 incredible leaders in ARIA who lead the chapters. And, their role is quite, it's not a technical role, but it requires them to deal with a lot of change. And then we've spent a lot of time focusing on that, like, how do you hold productive discomfort and how do you sit in the gray and what does that look like? And then when you lift that up to the C-suite level, that's their job. Mm. They just sit in that all the time. But it's really around, you can't just jump in to solve some of these problems that we don't know yet. There's no solution. There's no roadmap that we all are working towards.
Yeah.
And it's actually really being comfortable with that discomfort.
Yeah, amazing. I'll jump into some of the Slido questions. And I'll start with the one from Nick, actually. It says, with 600 people reporting under you, what's your secret sauce to maintaining AI innovation and progress as a top priority across so many people at once?
I think it's just my passion area for me personally. Innovation is my passion area. Now that we've got a better, the function was completely new when I joined a year ago. So it took us a bit of time to get the kind of up and running and the team running and stuff. And we still have lots to do, but, it's humming along well. And the team, good engagement. It's back. Ultimately, comes back to my love of learning, and I do something that I don't know if many executives do, but I don't take any meetings on a Friday, purposely. And I really spend my Fridays reading and just as much as possible having time to think, and just that ability to absorb as much as possible. I think we spend way too much time in meetings, and way too much time content switching during the day. So, if you want to be innovative, you have to actually let your brain wander. And I think we don't do enough of that. So
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a really unappreciated and undervalued.
And something actually culturally it's hard to hold yourself because it's just so many meetings. And especially the virtual working, everyone lives in it now, but have to find that space to constantly
And carving it out is really kudos for that. That is phenomenal. Question, the top voted one there is, what are your thoughts on managing staff remotely? Does this change your employee growth and development strategy?
Yeah, so where we are now, it's a remote working, and Telstra as a telco has been like that for many years. So it's sort of not a new thing at Telstra. I've got people in India, all over Australia, New Zealand, Tassie, Singapore, Philippines. And then how do you keep the team engaged and the development strategy? Yeah, we've really tried to work through that hybrid one. We do a lot of building, you've got to think differently about building culture and purpose and does that look like? We had a Melbourne Connect earlier today and the team have run events around, human versus machine, and they've got lots of things going like that. But we carve out people development days. So one day a month, everybody has a day focusing on their own development, and we run sessions during that day and we run different training challenges, etc. So it's kind of the norm in our world. So it's not really getting people into the office and connecting in person tends to be harder than actually the online working.
Agreed. Yeah, that's really good.
lunches tend to work.
Oh, 100%, right? Yes, that's when you go, oh, why is everyone into that? Ah, yeah,
pub lunch. There's food.
Next question is, how is the uplift of skills measured? Is it a total workforce uplift or individually assessed? This is going back to one of the discussions that we were having towards the beginning.
Yeah.
How do you guys measure it?
Yeah. So last year in my chapter, we did a skills measurement, which was a survey-based skills assessment, which at least baselined where our skills were at. This year, the team have got a proof of concept launching now at the moment, which is looking at both the self-assessment and the also then like what are the courses they've done during the year and what skills have they acquired and what percentage scores have they got on those skills. So like we for example in the Microsoft challenges, if they've rate, you know, if they've got 50%, do we need to continue to educate them on other things, etc., within that? And we've looked at other tools externally as well, that we could are looking at exploring, but it's all comes down to investment. So we're building that out at the moment.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. I wanted to ask you this question about AI capability versus data analytics capability. So question is, how does presenting AI capability, how is it different to presenting data analytics capability in the past? So as in like whether AI, presenting AI capabilities needs a different approach to presenting data and analytics capabilities that sometimes, and one of the questions that we had in an earlier session was, for example, should the two live in separate strategies? For example, having a data strategy and then an AI strategy, and whether they need to be presented differently to the board. I can see you got some good views here.
There was a cartoon picture somebody sent to me last week that says, can you send me your data strategy? And then the other one was like, can you send me your AI strategy? And it's like, I'm still working on my data strategy.
Nice.
We're taking the view of we've got our company strategy. Yes, we've got a game plan, a blueprint that we need to put in place to build out the data and AI core capability.
Yeah.
But the business strategy drives the value and data and AI enables that. So we're trying not to say you've got to have an AI strategy and a data strategy. Yeah. We've got a corporate strategy and it's enabled by data and AI. That's the posture for that. But then underneath that, we have kind of six layers, which we've orchestrating it behind, of which it has, you know, your core data layers and then your AI layers. And so it's kind of like your platform is your management, your AI layer, and then people and value. And effectively within that, we have our blueprints.
And that's from a capability perspective.
Core capability. Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
As in like platform, process, data management, governance, people, value.
Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting because I totally understand this question that even, well, for me earlier in my career, I was very adamant to have a data strategy, to have a AI strategy. And looking back, what I realized later is that it's because I felt then I owned it, you know, and then I was kind of like championing this. But as time has gone on, I've now changed to the exact approach that you mentioned, that like there's a company strategy that has and needs to have AI and data embedded in there. And that's where the value is. And then the capabilities is what supports the, the core capabilities. Yeah. That's really good.
Awesome. Yeah. And I guess it's also evolving, you know, when we now look at, you know, AI, of which, you know, the pillars of AI, with generative AI is just one of them. But when you look at that and you think about how you've got to like orchestrate that within the organization, it's a different skill set as well. Like, there's a different, I guess, framework around how you want to be rolling that out, because depending on, you know, whether it's off the shelf or it's a vendor product or it's you're customizing something or you're creating it, there's different categories of both risk and usage and education that you need to do that's different.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. That change management and adoption piece will vary drastically. Mm-hmm. Great. I'll do maybe one more from Slido, another where basically out of time, but I'll do one more from Slido and then I'll ask you one more. One from Slido. Any books or other content you would recommend on adaptive leadership and productive discomfort?
Any books?
Or can be other courses.
I will send some. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I Mush Consulting is who I use for adaptive leadership. In USH, I think it's something to do with a butterfly transforming. But adaptive leadership, there's lots of different books. I can probably send them around so that they're on the podcast. And then I listen to a podcast about leadership and adaptive leadership. I love Brené Brown, for anybody who follows Brené Brown. But, you know, I think that was a pivotal point in my career, was when NAB, where I was working, sent me, like, we went on an 18-month adaptive leadership challenge, and it completely changed my approach to, like, work and leadership.
Amazing, amazing. And was that built kind of around the, so Brené Brown, like the...
No, this was a long time ago, but before? It was there's a recognition back then, I think, in leadership about having that ability to look at complex problems, not as technical solutions. So you'd actually go out and look at, like, you know, social injustice issues, and then look how, you know, the system and how you've got to work within the system. So that adaptive thinking really helps in actually, you know, when you're looking at a problem, but, you know, you've got to look at it from so many different angles, which is the kind of, which is where we are now.
I think it's really transformational in the people's leadership journey to make that step, because I see often, I see myself in other people, we're discussing with them, often with my team, for example, that the solution to every problem is tech, or is, you know, it's like, we just got to write some software that does this, or we have to get some IoT sensors that can measure this. And out of the list of possible ways to solve that problem or capture that data or analyze it, yes, that's one of, and when you consider many other dimensions that the solution will be measured against, that's probably one that could be expensive to buy, difficult to roll out, and like there's other kind of like low-hanging fruit. So I really... So
that's the world of proof of concepts.
Yes, right? Yes, test it out. One last question. I do want to ask you about how you see the, and this is a big question again, exactly, the world changing as a result of AI. What's there's obviously so many changes now. I'll leave it as an open question. Lots of changes coming down the pipe. What type of, obviously there's pressures across the board on wages, on inflation, AI coming in, heaps of disruption. How do you think people could look at the world and their careers and what's coming up next?
You know, in America, we're obviously where at the moment, you know, all this AI is kind of coming out of. And you look at the current economic climate, and you look at sort of the labor market over there, and they've got one of the lowest ever labor, the number of labor claims coming in are at the all-time low. You've got about 10 million jobs unfilled. I think for every unfilled job is about 0.6 actual people available to fill those jobs. And you're dealing with an aged population, which is only going to increase over time. So, you know, if I look at just that kind of environment, you then end up with sort of like, well, how do we sustain the some of the key tasks that we do today? And there's a lot of focus then around, well, how does AI then fill that gap? And therefore, we're at this cusp of, you know, with where we've, you know, compute and quantum compute and the storage costs going down, that, you know, AI is now at that, as everyone knows, kind of inflection point. And, you know, it's really around how do we use AI to drive more efficiency in what we do and be way more effective in what we do, as opposed to necessarily replacing jobs or replacing roles, but giving you back that time. But to look at that, you really have to look at the divergent workforce that you want to build and that human machine coming together. And then in particular, you've got to look at, you know, what, obviously you would have talked about risk a lot today, but like really how do you want, which side of history do you want to be on from a risk perspective and an ethics perspective and a responsibility perspective? And that's kind of where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, 100%. Yes. So AI will definitely help us increase the productivity that people have, the reach, the impact, but yeah. You see it as being, yeah?
Yeah, and I guess, like, I mean, if we look at some of the things that are happening in sciences and in energy, it's phenomenal. But I think, you know, it's just, we're on a cusp of something that I haven't seen at this pace before. But there's a lot of macro, I guess, indicators that are showing that it's not going to go away.
Right, so, yeah. And I remember when I was at university, like, I don't know, 100 years ago, feels like, one of the big talks was that in the early 2000s, there was going to be a huge need for computer engineers to build hardware. So hardware design, and that, you know, by 2005, Intel would have had to hire every computer engineer coming out of every university in the US in order to keep up with the amount of hardware that needed to be designed. Obviously, that didn't happen. And part of that was because of the increase in software and automation, which breached the gap, so that now there's such a small amount of computer engineers working in hardware that it's crazy. And now this is happening on the
other side. Prompt engineering is the new capability in town, so, you know.
That's it. All right, Orla, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for sharing your perspectives. The point of views that you have are phenomenal, and your knowledge and experience is outstanding. Thank you so much for taking the time to share all that with us today.
Thank you.
Orla Glynn, thank you.
Thanks for watching this video all the way till the end. I hope that you got a lot out of this discussion. And if you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe to the channel. So more people can find out about the challenges that leaders have in the analytics and AI space. And that's what we're trying to share in Data Futurology. So please like and subscribe. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please tell your friends. Thank you so much.